Chapter 7. Goron, in Fett's absence, I think you really ought to see this. I don't think it can wait. Sometimes the Vongees do you a favor.
Site Foreman Herrick Vorod, on examination of excavated rock from land north of Enseri, Mandalore.
Safe House, Coruscant.
So you're going to do it before you achieve your full Sith powers,
said Lumia. She lit the candles and closed the blinds. Jason needed to shut out the world and feel what was happening. He was running increasingly on a mundane agenda, the agenda of the lesser beings he worked with.
Why?
If I do it afterward, when might afterward be?
Jason watched the flames shimmering and settled down cross-legged on a floor cushion, but his eyes kept wandering away from the focus of concentration, and Lumia felt obliged to rap him sharply on the top of his head and point at the candle.
Omis is doing a deal with Gedgen. The deal excludes me and Neothel, possibly in a rather terminal way.
Working in the world of those who couldn't use the Force, Jason was falling into conniving and manipulating just like them. And while Lumia didn't think that was a bad thing, all tools were valid to achieve the outcome, he was letting himself be bound by their rules. He was talking about timing. He had full mastery of the Force, but he seemed to enjoy using the limited tricks of ordinary people. The Admiral was irrelevant in the long term. He had to be aware of that.
Neothel is afraid of you, Jason. Or at least wary.
Don't you think I know that? She'd be an idiot if she trusted anyone at this level of government.
You waste too much energy playing mundane's games instead of using the Force.
I'll use it when I need to. Most of the time now it's overkill.
Jason always seemed to want to prove how much smarter, how much more skilled he was than his adversaries, how he could beat them on their own terms. Vanity wasn't always a bad thing in a Sith, as long as it didn't control him. It was just a matter of getting him to pause and refocus.
Meditate, said Lumia.
Jason stared through her for a moment, and then stared unblinking at the candle until he eventually closed his eyes. He opened one eye slowly, looking as if he might be about to make a joke. Lumia didn't feel in a humorous mood.
Actually, I called you for a reason, he said.
I know, but I'd like to approach this like Force users, not like some tedious little committee in the Senate.
It was time to remind him he still had one more step to take before he could begin to teach her anything.
Calm yourself and put the world to one side.
Jason shut his eyes again, and, for once, seemed to relax enough to allow a little of his state of mind to filter through the barrier that he now kept in place most of the time. Lumia sensed the solid confidence and focus that typified him. But there was still the faintest hint of the old Jason, wounded by bereavement and pain, scared of doing necessary things. That was the last tinge of doubt and reluctance that his final step would erase. It would enable him to cross the line into his full Sith legacy. She didn't know when afterward might be either, or even who. She only knew it was soon.
You don't need to play their games, Jason, she said softly. Even now, Your powers put you far beyond their reach. Omis can't touch you, neither can Gedjon. When you achieve your destiny, they'll be less than irrelevant.
Powers or not, I can't control a galaxy on my own. I need to persuade, to carry people with me. The Force can't affect the minds of millions.
Ah, you enjoy the power you can wield with simple mind games. Don't make Palpatine's mistakes. That's an indulgence. It's not worthy of you. Jason, she said, I want you to take stock and feel. Stop overanalyzing. It won't reveal any truths to you. Just facts. Facts only show you what you want to see.
Jason opened his eyes again. But it's so fleeting. The line between a crazy impulse and guidance from the Force is getting harder to draw.
Because you think about it too much.
The impenetrable wall went up again. Lumia felt it as he lapsed into silence.
It's Ben, he said at last. It has to be Ben. Now she understood.
You're fond of the boy. Perhaps he's the child you don't have. This will be hard, and that's probably why it has to be him.
For a moment, Jason's gaze flickered, too brief, too insignificant for any ordinary observer to spot, and she knew she'd hit a nerve. That was it. Conscious of his own mortality, he wanted a son, and there was a little subconscious desire to possess what was Luke's as part of the overthrow of the Jedi dynasty. Now that he had it, and Ben looked at him as a heroic father figure, he had to throw away that prize. It was an odd sort of love, but if it was powerful enough, it would do fine.
That's probably it, Jason said, and looked down at his clasped hands. And it's hard to kill someone who doesn't deserve it.
But you don't know how it'll happen.
Exactly.
You can't see yourself taking a lightsaber to a 14-year-old boy.
Maybe it won't be so literal. I'm sending him to assassinate Dur Gedjon when he meets Omis to do his deal. It's a job that needs doing. It tests Ben's skills and commitment. It's far easier for a teenage boy to get past Gedjon's security, and perhaps it will put him in real mortal danger.
Jason reached out to the low table nearby, leaning on one hand to stretch and pick up one of the candles in its transparent blue holder.
Now is that a consequence of the task? Or is that why I'm sending him? Am I sending him to his death?
Let it play out, Lumia said. Stop rationalizing and let it happen.
She stood up to take the candle from him. She could see he wanted to play that brinkmanship game again of how long he could hold his hand in the flame. Some men would do it out of bravado after too many drinks, but Jason was testing himself, a private struggle rooted in his experience of pain at Vergere's hands and his lingering doubts that he could stay the course and make himself do something he wanted to run from.
I need your help, he said. I need you to distract Mara for a while.
Whatever you wish,
She's taken the Brescia story to heart. Nothing like killing someone's child to guarantee a blood feud, is there?
I thought that story might tie her up and explain my presence. In an ideal world, I would have avoided all contact with the Skywalkers.
So, why did you offer your hand to Luke, instead of taking his head off?
Lumia was still considering that. She might not have meant Luke any harm, but she didn't have to hate someone to kill him in the line of duty. Did it matter that he still thought all her actions were dictated by an old romance and by a trauma that had been her destiny anyway? Why did she feel the need to show him they weren't?
It certainly had its shock value in the fight, she said, and killing him would have changed the course of events for all of us.
And you wanted to put him in his place, show him he had no leverage, that you were over him?
Jason sometimes seemed to understand, and then he'd say something banal like that, which made her think he had missed the point of passing through powerful emotions to become stronger.
The Skywalkers are too mired in their domesticity to be effective Jedi, Jason, she said. It's a warning to us all. Luke can't see what's in front of him because he thinks my motive is lost love and revenge, because that's the level he thinks at. Family and friends. It would never occur to him that I want to see a Sith-controlled galaxy, and that the personal issues we had are trivial by comparison.
You taught me that anger and passion are what make Sith strong.
There's anger, and then there's being controlled by it, not seeing the forest for the trees.
Lumia had a moment of self-doubt and decided to meditate on it later.
So what about Mara?
She's hanging on to that GAG connection she found to track you. Keep her occupied elsewhere.
I'll let her find me. That should do the trick. Can you give me a possession of Ben's? Something that would prove to Mara that I could get at him easily, without being traceable to you?
I'll get you a pair of his boots. He keeps several pairs in his locker, and Mara already suspects a GAG connection.
He gave her a little frown of concern, but she felt nothing emanating from him.
What if she actually catches you?
I might win. And anyway, it'll buy you time.
Lumia was still testing herself to see if she resented Jason for leaving her to die, too.
I'm expendable, as you've proven. My life's purpose is to enable you to become a Sith Lord, because that secures the stability of the galaxy. The ambition of most beings is just to stay alive, overeat, spend too much, and avoid hard work. I'm happy that I can achieve much more than that. And we all die, sooner or later. A death in service of a great ideal is a fine thing.
Jason gave her a long, blank stare, and she wondered if the idea of an eternal principle being more important than the short confines of his own mortal life was alien to him. He had to pass beyond that. He would.
When you think of Ben's fate, she said, think of the legacy you'll leave in years to come, and ask who'll be able to name the Skywalkers, or even the Solos. This is about the fate of trillions upon trillions for millennia to come. Not one small family over a few decades.
Jason got to his feet. but Lumia could tell he was looking at her without seeing her now.
"I'll keep telling myself that," he said. "The boots will get Mara's attention for sure."
"I think I'll play up the maternal grief and do something emotional, too. What are you going to do when Mara and Luke come after you? When they find out about Ben in due course?"
"I'll deal with that when I have to."
"It might be sooner than you think. I suggest you make sure you're properly armed."
"I have quite an armory," said Jason, "and I'll be ready when the time comes."
"Think laterally," Lumia said gently. "Luke can still take you in a lightsaber fight."
"I'm already a few steps ahead of him. Trust me." She had to. The future of the galaxy depended on Jason. He was the end of chaos and the beginning of order. And, like all forces of change, he would not be hailed by everyone as a savior. Some wouldn't see how necessary he was. Some would try to stop him. She would do whatever it took to clear his path, even if the price was her own life.
Surveillance Center, GAGHQ, Coruscant. Captain Gyrdon loomed in the doorway, backlit by the light from the corridor.
"Showtime," he said. "Neothel's just been designated as acting chief of state as of midnight."
The troopers on duty in the listening post looked up. Ben detached the bead amplifier in his ear and tried to make sense of that news. "What's happened to Omus?"
"He's going to be out of the office for a day."
"Oh, I thought..."
"He has to give a little notice, to hand over the reins of state to Neothel when he's out of contact. You know, command codes, that kind of stuff. So we have a window for his trip to Volpter. Tomorrow."
It was all moving too fast. Ben could recall feeling excited by the turmoil of events, but now that he was part of them, they were too fast for his comfort. They brought him closer to his mission. He wasn't relishing the prospect. He knew how he'd felt after killing a suspect he thought was armed, so he could work out that he wouldn't be any happier after dispatching Gedgen.
"I'm an assassin, and everyone else my age who isn't a Jedi is in school."
"What cover story has he given?" Ben asked.
"Private medical matter."
"Yeah, saving his backside," said Zavirk.
"I think this is the opportunity you've been waiting for, Ben."
Gyrdon beckoned to him.
"Come on, briefing room."
He turned to Zavirk.
"I want to know his itinerary to Volpter. He won't be taking us along, but he'll still need transport, a minder, and a pilot. So let's keep an eye on the logistics."
"Bet he takes an intel zombie or two with him for company."
"Well, we're keeping an eye on them, too, so that'll help us triangulate, won't it? Get to it, trooper."
The captain strode off down the corridor whistling, which was unlike him. Ben hadn't realized Gyrdon disliked Omus so much. Maybe he just enjoyed a really major hunt. It couldn't get much bigger than tailing the chief of state to an illicit meeting with the enemy. There was no hate in Gyrdon, just a wonderful sense of focus and excitement. Ben wondered if darkness was as easy to spot as Jedi seemed to think. But what's darkness? Killing Gedgen? The worst thing about growing up was that there were fewer right or wrong answers every day. It wasn't a math test. When they reached the briefing room, Chevu and Lecauf were already there, poring over a wall full of illuminated holodisplays, Lecauf, looking far from comfortable in his brand-new lieutenant's rank insignia, gave Ben a nervous grin. Our source in Coronet confirms that Gedjan's rescheduled all his engagements for tomorrow, said Shavu. It's on, for sure.
Timetable?
No outbound timings, but he expects to be back in time for a meeting by 0800 the next day.
The displays on the walls showed two sets of charts and data. One was Coruscant, the other Corellia. Ben checked off the list of surveillance points. Omis's private residence, the security cams from the Senate offices, the handful of private landing pads nearest to both, and a tally of flight plans filed for Vulptor. The Corellian status board also showed recent flight plans logged with that planet as a destination.
What if Omis breaks his journey somewhere and doesn't fly straight to Vulptor?
Ben asked.
That's where marrying it up with arrivals and flight plans for Vulptor helps.
LeCalf pointed to a datapad on the table.
Check that out. Even if the flight doesn't originate from Coruscant, we can run checks to see what's arriving with Coruscant as its point of departure within that time window.
The boring number-crunching stuff, said Gyrden. Don't worry. A computer's narrowing down the choices. Once we spot Omis moving, or even Gedjan, then we put a tail on them. Easier to tail Omis, but we might get a break from Gedjan.
How?
We have an informant in the Corellian government building. This is the thing about information, Ben. It's not a case of finding a big X on a chart labeled "The Secret Meeting is Here." It's actually about assembling a lot of apparently routine stuff that's not secret at all, and looking for the patterns.
Ben watched the flight plans from Coronet appearing on the screen. Any neutral pilot entering Corellian airspace could get access to this. Anybody could get information from ATC on Vulptor. And Coruscant ATC was an open book, available from any data port. There was a daunting amount of data, but a computer or a droid could sift through it just as they sifted through the thousands of comlink calls to flag those that were worth the scrutiny of flesh and blood. It was just a matter of setting the parameters right. Ben wasn't sure why he was here, other than to learn the tedious and painstaking side of the job. Shavu and LeCalf seemed to be planning an interception.
They're just working out how we get you close enough to Gedjan.
Gyrden seemed to assume Ben knew what he was talking about.
And that has to be after he's finished his meeting with Omis, because the boss wants the evidence of the meeting for the Security Council.
Revelation dawned. Ben had hoped he'd have more preparation time. But this was it.
We're doing the hit at the same time as the meeting? Not when he's on the way back, or...
We might not get another chance to take a crack at Gedjan away from his home turf.
LeCalf beckoned to Ben and made him look inside a fabric holdall leaning against the wall.
Like it?
Ben couldn't work out what it was at first, but when he took it from the bag, it turned out to be a rifle with a folding stock. He unfolded it and snapped the stock into place, staring at it in numb realization.
It's a modified Karpaki 50, LeCalf said,
totally misreading Ben's reaction to the weapon.
Can't leave lightsaber marks all over Gedjan, can we? Bit of a giveaway. You're now going to make a very fast acquaint of a ballistic sniper rifle. You know, projectiles.
If you're trying to get me close to Gedjan, why do I need a sniper weapon?
In case we can't. Come on, let's get in a few hours on the indoor range.
Ben wondered if it was his last chance to refuse. But he knew he couldn't. If Shavu was taking part in this, and Shavu was dead straight, a man the other officers described as an old-fashioned kind of cop, then it had to be the right thing to do.
Gyrden responded to his chirping comlink.
It was Zavirk, judging by the side of the conversation that Ben could hear. Gyrden slid the comlink back in his pocket, a big grin on his face.
Intelligence is sending a couple of handlers with Omis, he said. Just overheard their arrangements. 0500 start, leaving from his private landing pad and transferring to an unmarked intelligence cutter in Coruscant orbit. Sneaky, eh?
but it helps when you know their code names for various VIPs.
He checked his chrono.
If I ever end up back in intelligence, remind me to make them better.
Got to go.
Shevhu raised an eyebrow.
He loves his work.
Are you okay with this? Ben asked.
Okay with what?
Gedgen.
I'm not a spook, Shevhu said. Never was. But if Gedgen has Omis killed, it'll destabilize the whole GA. So I'm okay with it.
Do you think he will?
I'd want proof that he wouldn't. Personally, I think we should blow our cover and stop Omis from going. But that just compromises our whole operation. So we're riding along with you to make sure Omis gets home in one piece.
Shevhu never made any comments on whether he thought Omis was a traitor betraying the GA or a visionary taking a massive risk for peace. He didn't get involved with politics and opinions. He just stuck to the law as best he could. And that wasn't easy in the GAG.
What are you waiting for? Shevhu asked.
I just wondered if you think I'm right to do this.
That's not my call.
Shevhu busied himself with holocharts of Vulptor, opening 3D images of the spaceports and public buildings.
You've got your orders.
LeCauf gave Ben a nudge in the back. Come on! I've got to turn you into a passable sniper by tomorrow morning. The indoor range had that ozonic discharged blaster smell with a tinge of burned plastoid. Something in the air made Ben's eyes sting. It was an expensive facility that LeCauf said had been cobbled together from equipment originally intended for intelligence. Hologram simulations, regular targets, and even something he called dead meat. I'm not sure I'm going to be much use with a rifle, Ben said. Aw, come on. LeCauf was unconvinced. You're a Jedi. You're not like the rest of us. You've got this visuospatial ability we haven't. My granddad used to tell my dad amazing things about Lord Vader. Really uncanny accuracy in three dimensions, whether he was flying a ship or using a weapon. I used to think Dad was making it up, until I saw real Jedi doing that stuff. Why not a blaster? Loads of reasons. We need overkill. We need something that doesn't light the place up like fireworks. And we want something that can be silenced. Believe it or not, that thing is quite discreet. Ben steadied the Karpaki against his shoulder, sighted up a few times, and took his firing position. He was quite pleased to get that far without making a fool of himself. You seem to have a good opinion of Vader. My granddad thought the world of him. When he got badly burned on a mission and had to be discharged from the Imperial Army, Lord Vader made sure he was taken care of for the rest of his life. Whatever some people say about Vader, monsters don't look out for lieutenants. That's good to know, said Ben. He liked the idea of his grandfather having his kind moments, and that some people still thought well of him. Not everyone had been sympathetic to the rebellion. Ben imagined Vader doing the difficult things that Jason was facing now. And that I'm facing. At the end of the range, a shadowy man walked quickly across Ben's field of view and vanished. Ben's instinctive reaction was that this person was real and breaking safety regulations, so he lowered his weapon and called a warning. LeCauf burst out laughing. Ben, that's your target. That wasn't a hologram. It was solid. Yeah. LeCauf put his hand on the control console, and the man walked back into view again to sit on a chair in the target zone. It's a gel form. It's an adjustable droid made of gel and plastoid to mimic flesh and bone. So you get used to a target moving like a real person. That one's been adjusted to match Gedgen's build and gait based on Holonews footage. So you get used to what he'll look like and how he'll probably fall. Ben was transfixed. It was just a dummy, just a clever piece of training technology. He checked it in the Force. Yes, it was just a machine. But he still felt awful about it.
That's pretty yucky.
You know how much those things cost?
What happens when I shoot it?
It gets up and repairs itself.
Okay.
Ben found it disturbing to watch the figure walking around in the small bay at the end of the range. Through the rifle's optics, it was clearly a featureless, translucent gel figure with the shadowy framework of artificial bone within.
You sure it doesn't feel anything?
It just moves, Ben. It doesn't think. It's not even a proper droid, more like a puppet. He looked at the chrono display on the wall. You've got less than 19 hours to get up to speed.
No pressure, then.
In your own time, fire when ready. Ben recalled his recent training.
Why not center mass?
That's the Army way. Kill or wound, you've still put the target out of action. Police snipers have to worry about hostages and stuff, so they're trained to incapacitate instantly. Headshot. Assassination doesn't have to be as instant, just dead. But a headshot's still best.
LeCouf crooked his forefingers and thumbs 5 centimeters apart and made a gesture as if he were putting on a blindfold.
That's the zone you're aiming at. A 5-centimeter band around the head at eye level. Put one in there and you've got a kill. But with the kind of frangible round you'll be using, as long as you hit the head or neck at all, the result's the same.
What if I can only get a shot at center mass?
He won't respond to cardiopulmonary resuscitation after a round hits him. Believe me.
When LeCouf was getting technical, Ben knew he was enjoying his subject.
Optimum is still the headshot, though.
But there's wind speed and everything.
This Karpaki has smart sensor optics, senses the windage and allows for it. They've improved a bit in recent years.
If it's that clever, then why do I have to train?
To get used to shooting someone who's not trying to kill you, who doesn't even know you're there. Not the Jedi way, is it?
It was just a dummy, but it moved like Gedgen. Ben aimed. It was just like using a lightsaber, really, letting the Force guide the hand, the eye. He squeezed the trigger as the gel form sat down on the chair, and the round caught the point of its right temple. Gel and fragments plumed in the air, and the dummy slumped forward. LeCouf, arms folded, considered the inert form with the eye of a connoisseur. Ben was taken aback by how uncomfortable it made him feel, especially when the gel form suddenly sat upright, then stood. He was sure he couldn't shoot it a second time.
And again? Said LeCouf.
Ben spent the next hour getting used to anticipating movement, waiting for the gel form to settle for just long enough to take the shot. It was harder than he thought. The dummy made no impression in the Force, which limited Ben's senses, and it kept getting up and walking around each time, a distressing gel ghost of a man he was going to kill. There was no emotion in it. That made it hard, but he was getting good single shots. He tried to see it as a technical exercise, like lightsaber drill, an action totally separate from the nasty business of taking off heads, and imagined the gel form with the short dark hair of Der Gedgen.
Ben, LeCouf said quietly, I'll be there, and so will Shevu. You've got backup if anything goes wrong. If you can't get at him, or you don't get a clean shot, we'll make sure he drops and stays down. Don't sweat it.
But that'll expose you to. Like I said, it's just in case things don't go according to plan.
Makes sense to build in some contingency, in case we don't get another chance, because it'll be easier than hitting him on Corellia.
Ben pondered.
We don't even know the location. I could be doing this in the middle of a field or a crowded restaurant.
You sabotaged Centerpoint. This is going to be a lot easier.
When I did that, I still thought it was fun.
Come on. You can do it.
There was something about LeCouf's faith and admiration that galvanized Ben. He concentrated on the dummy and tried to see himself not as shooting a helpless automaton or even a corrupt politician, but as solving a problem. A couple of hours later, he was hitting the 5-centimeter zone 95% of the time.
"Better have a break now," LeCouf said.
Ben checked to make sure the adjacent lanes were clear and walked up the range to look at the gel form. The more times he'd hit it, the slower the self-repair became. Its internal power supply needed recharging. It was struggling to get up, and Ben found himself increasingly disturbed as he watched the pathetic, anonymous figure scrambling to roll onto its chest and get on all fours. He forced himself to stop looking at it. It was all the worse for there being none of the real aftermath of injury that he'd seen once too often.
"Lunch!"
LeCouf called, more insistently this time. Ben wasn't certain he was that hungry. Bevin Vassar Farm, 10 kilometers outside Keldabe, Mandalore. Goran Bevin looked up from the trench, a pitchfork in one hand and a muddy grin on his face. It was beginning to rain, and he was up to his ankles in animal dung, but it seemed to make him perfectly happy.
"And they said being acting Mandalore would go to my head," he said, rubbing his nose on his sleeve. "So you came home fast, then?"
Fett kept his distance.
"Found what I was looking for. You didn't expect me back."
"I did. Some of the clan chieftains didn't. You have a habit of wandering off for a few years at a time."
Bevin heaved himself out of the trench and wiped his palms on the seat of his pants. He looked very, very pleased with himself.
"If you'd been away any longer, I'd have called you. But since you're back, want to see something amazing?"
Fett wondered if now was a good time to tell Bevin the truth about his illness. The man had to know sooner or later. He could have formally declared himself Mandalore while Fett was gone, and probably found a lot of support among the clans. But he hadn't. He'd gone on shoveling dung and running his farm. He was happy with his life as it was. The galaxy would have worked better with a few more Bevins around.
"Okay," Fett said. "Amaze me."
Bevin beckoned and trudged through the mud toward the farm buildings. The fine drizzle was turning into rain, and the land looked bare. Not in the ruined sense of the post-war devastation that blighted so much of the planet, but as if it had settled down to sleep for the coming winter. Despite the derivation of the Fett surname, derived from the word for farmer, and his father's childhood on his parents' Concord Dawn farm, Fett knew nothing about agriculture. He wished he could learn, sometimes, to better understand who his father had once been.
"Myrta behaving herself?"
Bevin didn't look back over his shoulder.
"Well, at least she hasn't tried to kill you again. It's a good sign. Kids can be such a handful."
Fett felt the mud suck at his boots.
"She's a useful pair of fists in a fight."
"She'll produce wonderfully ferocious great-grandchildren for you, Bobica."
Bevin paused a few beats. Fett tried to take in the phrase great-grandchildren, and it left him stranded.
"So whatever it was you went to do ended in a fight, did it?"
"Just had to ask questions emphatically."
"You going to tell me about it?"
It seemed as good a time as any, and Fett didn't see the point of sugarcoating it.
"I'm terminally ill. 2 years, tops. 8-9 months if I carry on like this.
Bevin still didn't turn around. He walked on for a few more meters, head lowered against the rain, and then stopped in his tracks and finally faced Fett. He looked genuinely upset. Fett couldn't recall anyone being upset for him before, except his father. Lack of caring worked both ways. Maybe Sintas had felt for him. He hadn't noticed.
"You're not going to sit back and let it happen, are you, Bobica? We can do something, surely."
Using the way-too-familiar form of his name didn't bother Fett at all now.
"I found a clone who survived."
"So they did get a little more out of Ko's sigh than revenge and a few souvenirs, then?"
"There's no research data. Just the clone, Jang Skirata. He wouldn't give me a blood sample, but he says he's got good medical resources."
Now that Fett was back on Mandalore, and Jang was light years away, though, the whole premise struck him as flimsy. The man hadn't even accepted a meal from him, which would have at least left useful traces of his genetic material on the utensils. Fett had nothing except time counting down, and a suspicion that his judgment was failing just like his health.
"I'll explain later."
"Why didn't you tell me? I could have tracked some clones for you. Enough of them deserted and ended up here."
"Ones who'd had the accelerated aging stopped?"
"I don't know, but I could have worked from those leads. Shab, Bobica. Couldn't you have squeezed a little sample out of him anyway?"
"It's done now. And there was never a guarantee that Town Wee or Belwine could make anything from it anyway."
Bevin looked disappointed for a moment, as if Fett had let the side down by not simply grabbing what he needed. But Jang had been right. Fett needed Town Wee to decode whatever it was in that clone's cells that stopped the degeneration, and Town Wee would have turned that research over to her new bosses at Arcanian Micro. That was a bad deal for the clone, and a bad deal for Fett. Because if anyone was going to make credits out of that data, it was him. And Mandalore needed those...
"Well, there's a funny thing. Now I'm thinking long-term."
Bevin turned around and started walking again in silence. Fett's news had certainly taken the shine off whatever had made him so happy a little earlier. The farm was a rambling collection of buildings scattered around a stone farmhouse with impressive dirtworks and defensive walls. The other structures, including the outbuilding that Fett was staying in, weren't so well defended, just variations on the traditional circular veyame set in deep pits and so thickly thatched that they were camouflaged. But the farmhouse was the last bastion in the event of an attack. At the back of the building, and connected to it by an underground tunnel, stood a workshop with a smithy. Fett could hear the rhythmic hammering of metal across the clearing. There was no smoke curling from the roof. It vented many meters away to hide the location, and Fett was sure there was a network of tunnels extending a long way into the hills to the west of the farm. It was one of the ways the Mandalorians had fought and beaten the Yuuzhan Vong. Bevin walked down the steps cut into the hard-packed soil and leading down to the front door. It opened, and Dinua, his adopted daughter, stood with hands on hips.
"Boots,"
she said ominously, pointing at the clods of dung and mud. Two small children clung to her legs.
"You too, Mandalore. And you can take those coveralls off as well, Buir."
"Okay, okay."
Bevin, spy, fixer, veteran commando, was driven back by a resolute woman. But Dinua had fought and killed Yuuzhan Vong from the age of 14, so making a mess on her clean floor wasn't to be attempted rashly. "We'll go the long way around." They tramped around the perimeter of the farmhouse, following the sound of ringing metal.
"She's a good girl," Bevin said. "Just a bit irritable now that Jintar's away fighting. She's not one for staying at home. But the little ones are too young for both parents to be away."
So some had already taken mercenary work. Fett didn't think Bevin's farm was doing that badly, but maybe Jintar was too proud to accept his father-in-law's support.
"But you and Medrit are good with kids."
"Yeah, but this way one parent stays alive."
That was the harsh reality Fett had grown up with. It bred hard people. As the door to the workshop swung open, a blast of warm air registered on his sensors. The interior was bathed in a red glow. Sparks flew in arcing showers. How Bevin stood the noise, Fett would never know. His helmet controls had decided the volume was above danger level and buffered the sound. A mountain of a man in a singlet, burn-scarred leather apron, and ear defenders was hammering a strip of red-hot metal. Every time he raised his arm, sweat flew from him and hissed into steam on the hot surfaces. He folded the strip with tongs as he hammered, layering the metal with a steady rhythm that said he was a master armorsmith. After a while, he realized Fett and Bevin were standing watching. He gestured with an impatient jab of his finger to show he was going to finish working the metal before he'd stop to talk. It was actually fascinating. Fett could see from the length and emerging form of the metal bar that he was making a beskad, the traditional saber of the ancient Mandalorians. Bevin had one, an antique blade fashioned from Mandalore's unique iron, beskar. Fett had watched him swing the weapon so hard into a Yuuzhan Vong officer that he'd had to stand on him to pull it free.
"There!"
Medrit Vassar cooled the rough form of the saber in a tub of hissing liquid and turned it this way and that to check the line. He took off his ear defenders, and his face cracked into a beatific smile of satisfaction as he wiped the sweat from his brow with his forearm.
"Now that's going to be a thing of beauty."
"Medica, I haven't told him yet," said Bevin.
"Shall I blurt it out then?"
"You're the metallurgist."
"Mandalore,"
Medrit said stiffly,
"you're looking at a test forging from a new load of beskar."
It took Fett a slow second to grasp the importance of what Medrit had said.
"But the Empire strip-mined Mandalore. They took all the iron." "They missed a bit. A big bit."
"How? And how big?"
"This is a big planet with a tiny population. And even the Imperials didn't survey all of it. They stripped the shallow veins. This is a deeper load, and we'd never have found it if the Vong Yis hadn't left craters you could sink a small moon in."
Medrit picked up a cloth and wiped his face. Fett couldn't feel the full impact of the temperature in the workshop, but Bevin had started sweating visibly. He left a mucky smear across his forehead as he wiped it.
"There's a crew 100 clicks north of Inseri, still doing test drills. But it looks like a big, big load that was exposed."
Inseri was remote even by Mandalore's standards. No wonder it had taken years to stumble across it. The Yuuzhan Vong had used Singularity Ordnance indiscriminately, smashing huge craters across the planet because they wanted to annihilate Mandalore, not conquer it. Fett enjoyed a rare moment of pleasure imagining the look on their vile, arrogant, disfigured faces if they'd known they were helping Mandalore find a new source of the metal that had once made it mighty. Beskar was the toughest metal known to science. Even lightsabers had trouble with it. There had been a time when every army in the galaxy wanted a supply. It was still the most valuable metal on the market, and there was a war raging around them.
"I feel a new economic era coming on," said Fett.
Bevin winked.
"Oya, Manda."
"And it's not on anyone's land."
Fett realized the reason he'd never quite got a handle on what Mandalorian government actually meant was because it was so nebulous.
"This is a resource for Mandalore as a whole."
"If you say it is, then it is. That's the Mandalore's prerogative."
"Okay, I say it is. Time to gather the chieftains and do a little forward planning."
"Shob,"
said Medrit, underwhelmed by the Mandalore's power to requisition resources.
"You're sounding just like a proper head of state."
Fett would normally have found a family meal and a long explanation of the finer points of metallurgy worse than a spell in the Sarlacc. It was hard enough getting used to having a granddaughter without being besieged by Bevin's noisy, messy, demonstrative family. But that evening, he tolerated it.
"It's not just the ore,"
Medrit said, drawing an imaginary graph in midair with a Nuna drumstick.
"It's the processing. Part of the strength of the metal is in what's added during smelting and how it's worked. What you saw was just a test batch."
"Have we got the facilities to do that anymore?"
Fett wasn't used to eating in front of anyone else. Dinua's son and daughter, Shalk and Brila, 7 and 5, he estimated, stared at him unimpressed across the table. The scrutiny of small children was unnerving.
"Do we have a windfall we can't exploit?"
"On a small scale, we can do it," Bevin said. "I've done a few rough calculations. If the load produces the yield we think it will, we're going to need some help from mining right through to processing. Mandal Motors could process some of it, if they're willing to shift resources from combat craft. But the rest, we need droids."
"But what are you going to do with it?" Dinua asked.
"What?"
"Sell it for foreign currency, or use it to arm ourselves?"
Dinua, orphaned on the battlefield like Fett, was a savagely smart woman. Bevin had adopted her the moment her mother was killed. But Fett found that ability to turn strangers into family, that central part of Mandalorian culture, was beyond him. Even Medrit, impatient, critical, short-tempered, had accepted the unexpected addition to their household without a murmur. Adoption was what Mandalorians did, and always had.
"If he can do it, why can't I? With my own flesh and blood, too."
"We do both," said Fett, trying to stay on the subject. "Some manufactured goods for export. Some for our own rearmament."
"You'll find a lot of support for that," Bevin said. "Satisfies both camps."
"What else can I do with the time I have left to me, except leave Mandalore in decent shape? If we've got it, someone will want to take it."
"You think anyone's stupid enough to try invading like the Empire did?" Bevin said. "After we kicked Vong's shebs like that?"
"Babuwir's cussing," said Shalk gravely. "Can I say shebs too?" "No, you can't."
Dinua clicked her teeth in annoyance.
"Buir, please, not in front of the kids. Mandalore, how are you going to announce the find? Other than the old-fashioned Mondo way, by showing up at the border with an invading army."
"Do we have to announce it?"
if we want foreign revenue.
We don't have a finance minister, but the job's yours.
I'm serious.
Commission a few starfighters and see who notices,
Fett said.
Maybe this Kotika has a point, that we don't have to be on one side or the other. There's a third side, as Goron says.
It was only courtesy to address him by his first name in his own house. Fett had so little non-hostile interaction with anyone that basic etiquette felt like a minefield.
Our own.
I could make sure the Arue Tise notice, said Bevine, but maybe a surprise is better.
What kind of surprise?
The kind that makes you look up and run for a bomb shelter, Bevine said, with a Mandel Motors logo on the fuselage.
We've got no territorial ambitions beyond the sector. We've got at least a dozen planets here to worry about.
I know, but take a planet in post-war recovery, an ongoing civil war, and a new find of Beskar, and we might have visitors. If not armed, then at least trying to do deals.
Whatever. I don't lose sleep over what...
Bevine filled the gap. Arue Tise.
Arue Tise, think of us. I'll talk to Yomaget in the morning. See what Mandel Motors can commit.
Medrit chewed thoughtfully, staring at Fett.
You could have a decent set of Beskar Gam to replace that Durasteel Osic you're wearing, too. It'll last several lifetimes.
It only has to last a year, then.
Medrit stared at Fett, got no response, and turned to Bevine. He shook his head. Later. Dinua took the hint, too. Her kids gazed from face to face, looking for an explanation of what had plunged the grown-ups into silence. Fett was past caring whether anyone knew he was dying. Most wouldn't believe it anyway. It was hard to imagine the mortality of someone whose face you couldn't see.
"Plenty more, Nuna,"
Bevine said suddenly, pushing the serving plate of glistening, spice-crusted meat in front of him.
"Home-raised, too."
It was never going to be a relaxed family dinner anyway. Just being Fett made sure of that. The food was spicier than he was used to, and the portions were too big, but he cleared his plate because these were generous people who gave him a refuge here and who refused payment, even though he could have bought the entire planet twice over. It was what Mondo Ade did for one another when someone was in trouble. The fact that he was Mandalore was irrelevant. He could almost hear Medrit telling Bevine later what a surly Shabuir Fett was, and asking if Bevine really had to invite him around so often.
"You didn't tell me how the load was found," Fett said.
It was his best shot at small talk, given that they didn't seem to want to talk about his death.
"After 10 years? In the middle of nowhere?"
"From orbit."
Medrit paused in mid-slice as he carved a sticky pile of nut-studded glistening pastry into 6 portions and licked his fingers. Little burn scars peppered his hands. Fett wondered if he'd find metal filings in the cake.
"Some Mondo Ade coming home after a few generations in the Outer Rim. A minerals engineer and a geologist ran a few scans, compared them with the old geological charts, and decided to take a look on close approach. Result? Y.E.
"Good timing," Fett said.
"We're getting a lot of skilled people coming home, Bobica," Bevine said. "You said you wanted Mondo Ade to come back.
and some already have.
Impressive.
Fett was surprised at the willingness of people to abandon all they'd ever known simply at his suggestion.
Let's hope they're all that lucky.
More resourcefulness than luck. Fett thought of the last thing that Fen Shisa had said to him.
If you only look after your own hide, then you're not a man. No, Jang didn't have any idea what went on between them in those final moments. People generally believed what they wanted to.
Makes me wonder what else is still lying undiscovered on this planet, said Fett.
That night, lying awake far too long on the rickety trestle bed in the outbuilding, Fett reflected on the fact that Myrta hadn't been in touch since they'd returned, and wondered what his father would have done had he been Mandalore now. Exhaustion was the best sleeping pill he knew. Before he let it engulf him, his last thought was that the Beskar changed everything, except his own mortality.